Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of the Watson Weekly with Rick and Jess.
Hi, I'm Jessica Lisewski, and right now I am in 16-year-old driver mode, Rick, and I'm about to lose my mind. We can park that story for another day, but
ouch.
Yeah, we're in a whole new world here. Let's break down what's going on in this week's show.
Today's show is, first, the never-ending story of Saks Global. What are the seasons involved? Second, Walmart passes $1 trillion market capitalization. Number three, FedEx to narrow its e-commerce delivery for specialized shipments. And finally, we look at all the risks facing some of the biggest tech companies out there. So that should be a fun segment where we think of all the things that could really screw up.
We're going to give you a little Nostradamus action that we know we're all so good at.
Here exactly. We go. First up, we're talking about Saks. And if you didn't know, they broke.
This story has been unfolding almost like a soap opera, Rick, which we're calling As the House of Luxury Turns, the Saks Global Saga. So gather around, get your popcorn, because we're going to walk you through these seasons as if they were episodic, because it's what it feels like. You know, and it starts with February 2025, where we have this confession. Mark Metrick, the CEO of Saks Global, admits what everyone already knew. Vendors have not been paid, and some of them in 18 months. Ouch, right?
She broke. At the point where your vendors, it's like the canary in the coal mine.
Right.
I mean, usually companies don't tell everyone that they're not going to get paid because then they stop giving you, I don't know, inventory.
Inventory, trusting you, all the things that you kind of want to have. Like stores need things to sell.
Correct.
They expect to get paid in exchange for said things in the store. And this isn't a consignment model, right? They actually need to buy it up front, but they weren't getting paid. Hudson Bay's company, meanwhile, is also deteriorating. By June, those stores in Canada are fully liquidated and the empire is shrinking.
That's a big meanwhile, Jess.
That was a meanwhile, yes. The da-da-da, you know, in the saga. So season two, shelves go quiet. This is the summer of 2025. Brands complain. The smaller brands are revolting. They stop shipping inventory. Flagship stores begin to show the unthinkable in luxury, which is empty shelves. In October, revenue is down 13% to $1.2 billion. And 9 Saks off Fifth Avenue stores close.
They gone.
Season three, December, the missed payment. They miss $100 million interest payment. Oof. And in distressed debt terms, this is your point of no return. January 2nd, Metrick exits. Richard Baker steps in as the CEO, then he gone. And on January 13th, Saks Global files for Chapter 11.
Game over.
Yeah, this is 11 you don't want to hit. There's been a lot of numbers in the last few years. What I'm curious about is like, how do you spend over $2 billion for Neiman Marcus and then immediately go bankrupt?
Exactly. I mean, it is, the drama, Rick, also isn't done. So now in season four, the allies are turning against each other. They're becoming not even frenemies. It is straight up enemies. Minority investor Amazon's objecting to this bankruptcy plan, calling the $475 million investment presumptuously worthless. And they're saying, you're mismanaging cash. The closures accelerate. 57 Saks Off Fifth stores are gone. 8 full-line Saks stores. 1 Neiman Marcus store in Boston. And now the landlord, Simon Property Group, are demanding $19 million in unpaid rent.
That's a lot. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans and Saks was the anchor of one of the biggest malls downtown. And I don't know what's going to happen to that mall now. Like, she gone.
Almost this iconic legacy, which we, like we said, it's the house of luxury turning and it's turning on its head. You know, really this leverage leaves no margin for volatility. This vendor trust has collapsed. Like, you don't mess with Chanel. And they've been messing with Chanel. So
no way.
Look, they still own a lot of valuable real estate. The bankruptcy will solve all these lawsuits because eventually the court gets to decide which parent gets the kids, which parent gets you know, to spend the weekends, all these things. So there's a messy divorce coming with these vendors. I think the bigger challenge is like, what's the future of the American luxury market? There are very few players involved. Who is even luxury anymore? Is Nordstrom's now luxury? Like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, and Amazon is still trying to play the luxe game. But again, Saks is like exited stage right off that storefront.
Right.
So that inventory is gone. I guess they'll still rely on Shopbop. I mean, no way is Chanel or Louis Vuitton going to ever have a direct relationship with Amazon. And I will say never, because it seems to be something that at least that's their line in the sand.
Yeah.
So it does feel like American luxury has, is this the like season finale?
Yeah, I think we're to the season finale, and you know, we're looking to see if there's going to be another season. Does the show get renewed? We're just going to keep this going.
Is there a spinoff?
Yeah, sometimes season two is stronger. Usually, it's worse.
Yes, exactly. The sequels are not always better, people.
They are
all
not.
Right. So, as you always like to say, though, chapter 11 solves all problems, and we will see how this saga unfolds.
Exactly.
All right. So, let's bring in Walmart. There has been lots of big news happening there.
Yeah. Walmart has recently hit $1 trillion in market capitalization, which is actually the first retailer to hit that kind of market valuation of $1 trillion. That has traditionally been an elite tech-heavy club, NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft. I think Apple was maybe technically the first one to do it. NVIDIA did it shortly after. And this is the first player to do it that's not wearing a Silicon Valley hoodie. Instead, they're in the country out in Bentonville. Well,
yes.
Bentonville's no longer country anymore because, you know, it's Walmart's a big place.
So it's a little bit rock and roll.
There are a lot of office buildings there, but they've poured billions of dollars into supply chain automation, into it. It feels like Walmart is that company where you used to have these things where when Target was cool, you had blogs like the people of Walmart, right?
Right.
And then that narrative seems to have entirely flipped around. Now Target is the dump and Walmart is the bright, shiny place you go to. So they seem to have kept and built kind of a dual strategy. And the dual strategy is Walmart really never lost its soul. Like, we need to go after the budget conscious shopper.
Yeah.
We're going to always have the lowest price. No one's going to undersell us. A lot of autonomy to the store managers. And at the same time, their e-commerce transformation and their supply chain innovation has really allowed them to capture kind of the upper market, traditional almost Amazon customer is also now shopping at Walmart.
Right.
They're definitely stole share from Target,
yes,
as far as I'm concerned. And so what Walmart found is that we could sell to this higher end customer for some of our items because these people value assortment and convenience, and they've invested a lot into convenience.
Absolutely. And we've talked about William White leaving Target and going to Walmart, taking that playbook of how to build the brand and attract these customers that once probably shunned their nose or pumped up their nose at Walmart, but now they're shopping there like left and right. They brought in these celebrity partnerships like Drew Barrymore Home. And it's paying off also. These e-commerce growth rates north of 30%, which is 3x Amazon. We know marketplaces has been a really strong bright spot for them. Thank you, Jet. And this micro-fulfillment that they've been doing, coupled with their investment in acquisition of Vizio, has opened up new ad revenue. So they really are firing on all these cylinders that once people thought Amazon was just eating their lunch.
So Walmart is growing 2 to 3 times faster than Amazon in either e-commerce or north of 30%. Amazon is generally growing, depending on the quarter. In Q4, it's like 10-11%. In normal times, it's about 8% e-commerce. So they're growing faster than Amazon. The thought experiment I like to run is, but for Jet.com acquisition, is Walmart in the place that they are now? And so I think the answer is, despite the fact that they had to shut down Jet.com and they acquired a bunch of companies, which really didn't make a lot of sense, it didn't really hurt them.
Yeah.
What it ended up doing is Walmart got a sense of urgency. And I think the former CEO has a lot to do with this, Doug McMillon. And they infused a lot of sort of, call it dot-com culture into Walmart. And so I think that's the big story. And Jet.com could be one of the biggest successful failed acquisitions in the last 20 years.
Absolutely. It is a fail forward, right? And just to recap, you know, they bought Jet for $3.3 billion. All these other acquisitions, Bonobos, Moose Jaw, ModCloth, which didn't necessarily fit the traditional.
Don't forget Hay Needle, Jess.
Oh,
Hay Needle.
That's right. Oh my gosh, I totally forgot. So you've got like north of $3.8 billion in acquisitions, which now at the at the run rate that e-commerce is at, it's really a blip. And so I typically like to take the opposite position of what you have, Rick, but I think you're spot on in the sense that Jet did accelerate and the capital deployed, even though ultimately it didn't have legs that had the long-term runway, they did utilize that as a bolster to wake up their almost sluggish e-commerce growth prior to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. So Walmart is something, they just reported earnings. We're going to be reporting that. Probably next week, we'll break that down and then we'll see how the story continues to evolve.
So we're going to move on to FedEx. FedEx is saying there are some shipments that we don't necessarily want in our trucks anymore. So if you've ordered a basic t-shirt lately, they don't really care about that anymore. They've made it very clear as part of their investor day, they are not chasing every single packet. And they're kind of like, we're not for everyone.
Yeah, I feel like the rise of Amazon has forced a change in every carrier. There's kind of like two big supply chain forces that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years. One is the rise of all these de minimis shipments, Shein, Temu, and to a lesser extent, TikTok Shop. Second is the rise of Amazon and the continued, like UPS calls it, the glide down of Amazon parcels where, you know, Amazon was by far UPS's biggest customer. They're going to still be their biggest customer, but not on a percentage basis. Amazon's going to be taking more of their parcels. FedEx basically gave Amazon the Heisman years ago, except for international, which they actually, Amazon is a customer of FedEx International because FedEx has lanes that no one else can really match. What these two forces, the rise of de minimis and Amazon, has really forced carriers to come up with a different strategy. And it basically, Carol Tomei, the UPS CEO, has really summarized it better than anyone else, saying, better, not bigger.
Right.
And basically, that means lower volume, higher margin per parcel. And that's the strategy because you can't out Amazon. Amazon, they're growing too fast. They're too efficient. The stuff arrives too fast. There's no money to be made competing directly with Amazon.
It's not you.
And
margin.
People have tried, failed, and now it's throw in the towel time.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so what FedEx is effectively saying is we want sectors like healthcare, automotive, aerospace, data centers. That's our market opportunity, which they're saying has the serviceable addressable market of $130 billion. So get excited. Yeah. We love bees.
That's great.
Yeah, it's great. I don't know how that math maths, but here we are. And they're also saying that these like tiny, cheap shipments are going to free up this space because they're not going to take up network space anymore because they're basically just saying, no thanks, we don't want them. So where do these shipments go, Rick?
Yeah, these sub-pound parcels, I think they go to a lot of these regional carriers.
Yeah.
Pitney Bowes, for instance, was previously covering Shein's shipments. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine negotiating with Shein, you're not getting a lot of margin out of those things.
Right.
So I think a lot of these bigger carriers are not really upset about losing these business. I think they call it, the corporate speak, addition by subtraction.
That's right. That's right. And you were recently with FedEx. You had a keynote. Can you break down what went on there?
Yeah, the keynote was a big event for their FedEx partners. They get together a lot of their executives. FedEx is a big company. Even their own employees don't always get together in one room. So their partner team, Jeremy Clayson, was super nice to invite me out, Melinda Mosikowski, and a number of other people. So really appreciate giving sort of kind of the headline keynote of the event. I was talking about AI and supply chain. And so it was really kind of like following on sort of the Be Bold theme we introduced at NRF, which is we're entering the age of intelligence. That is going to affect supply chain as well. It's going to affect how we sell supply chain. It's going to affect how we think about supply chain risk. And it's also going to think about the simple consumer problems, like I ordered something from Walmart and it's not available. What do they offer me as a replacement? AI can even improve things like that.
Wow. It sounds like there's endless opportunity as it relates to where AI is going to impact supply chain. What's next for FedEx? Like, is this too little too late? Or you still think there's a runway for them to revamp the strategy and move in this direction successfully?
FedEx has always been a very solid carrier. The issue has been that they've been moving too slow. They were slow to integrate their ground network, you know, after buying RPS and others. And so they're finally making significant progress on their network 2.0 strategy. Basically, they're trying to play the slow follower to what UPS has been doing, which is like close facilities, don't need so many planes. FedEx has been like really slimming down, but they haven't said so FedEx in the last 2 years has said like, this is what we're not, but they hadn't done a great job of saying, this is what we are for.
Yeah.
And so it kind of feels to me like they're starting to make some of those decisions, which to me is always a positive sign. It's never too late to turn around a company.
That's right. That's right. Never too little, too late. Yeah. So we'll be watching this one as well. And how well do they make this pivot from small parcel to big parcel, and especially breaking into industries where they may not have as much of a foothold?
Did you even realize we had a newsletter? I think, Jess, you knew, but maybe all of our listeners didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
WatsonWeekly.com. It's a website. You can go there. You can sign up. You can get notified from us. We tell you about our podcasts going on, our events. We write original articles. Obviously, you see us on LinkedIn. But if you didn't know we had a newsletter, head on over to WatsonWeekly.com and subscribe.
Best part of your day.
Best part of your day. So our next story is all the risks facing tech companies in the next 12 months. We actually are going to talk about three or four companies in particular: Amazon, Shopify, Meta, and OpenAI. We're not going to talk about Walmart. We already spent a lot of time with them. But those are the four companies we're going to break down with what do we think are the biggest risks. And we're really not going to go into so much detail on each one. But if we're thinking about the next 12 months, what is the one existential risk we feel that the company takes?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to break it down, because these are the behemoths. These are the ones that are really carrying the tech sector at this point, a mix of AI, mix of retail, and each of them are not without some type of competitive threat, either to themselves or within the industry. So let's start with Amazon, Rick. What do you feel like is the biggest risk to the company right now?
Yeah, Amazon, the biggest risk they face right now is really AWS. AWS is kind of the franchise. And so what are they making? Amazon has basically stood on the table and saying, we cannot be outspent in AI, and said $200 billion CapEx. The only one that's really outspending them is perhaps NVIDIA and OpenAI, that kind of combination. But Amazon is outspending Google. They're outspending Meta. They're outspending Perplexity. Essentially, everyone on down the line. And so the risk to Amazon is that the $200+ billion sales pipeline that they sort of claim is in their AWS sales backlog for AI, it doesn't materialize. And so as a result, what they have is this $200 billion spending commitment that's oversized. And so the risk is like, okay, you see this big commitment, but then it doesn't happen. It's kind of like what they did with their logistics network post-COVID, where as they come into COVID, they doubled the size of the logistics network, which was good timing. But then COVID, you know, e-commerce started slowing down a little bit, which meant they had to push off those facilities in the future to avoid all that cash. And so that's kind of what they would have to do with data centers if this backlog doesn't materialize.
Yeah, that one will be interesting to watch as it unfolds. And then Shopify. So Shopify, it feels like one of their biggest risks is culture. And what talent can they attract when your narrative is AI can do your job? We don't necessarily need you. If you are focusing on AI first, you don't need to work here. So how can they attract talent in this environment with that type of narrative? Can you break that down for us?
It feels like CEO Toby Lutka has been on a multi-year journey to kind of reset the company's culture.
Yeah.
And I think that him, in combination with CFO Jeff Hoffmeister, who was the guy who originally sort of helped them at Morgan Stanley go public, their feeling has been, number one, we're not a family, we're a high-performance sports team. So as a result, you're not getting leftovers or pies at Thanksgiving.
No.
That's extra stuff.
Yeah.
Second is, especially with the AI revolution, anything that you can do with AI, we don't need another person for it. And so if you can't prove to us that AI can't do it, we're not going to keep you. Then they've gone even further in that existing roles, I mean, most commonly support, but recently sales and their partner program has been completely restructured such that, like, why are all these people standing around? Why is everyone out on these steak dinners? So we already talked about Shopify going vegan.
That's right.
That's really the part of that story. And so the drip, drip, drip message for Shopify is, you're not appreciated here. And so if you're a supposedly 100-year company, talent is a kind of an existential risk.
Yeah.
And so if the broader market says, hey, Shopify doesn't appreciate you, I'm sure Shopify is a great, fun company to work at. But if you're not at Shopify, you might not appreciate that if you're hearing the message constantly that AI is going to replace you.
Right. And what are the roles that really do feel strategic for you in a place that you can grow your career, especially as you think about recruiting top talent, fresh thinking? Yeah. So it will be interesting to see where like just the corporate culture goes and also the reality of what they can do with these jobs. Because we also know another company, Klarna, had a big line, you know, stake in the ground of AI, 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 and then found out, hey, we actually probably do need some people to talk to our customers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Shopify might figure out that out in a while, but you know, their support was already so bad that maybe their customers won't even notice.
That's true. Maybe the bots will be better.
Exactly. Can't be worse. On the Meta side, the biggest risk to Meta, I think, is kind of, you know, first of all, the whole name situation, that they were going to be in the metaverse, they're not in the metaverse. I think their biggest fears have already been realized. Mm-hmm. They're investing a lot behind what I call face computers, meaning what is that? It's basically meaning it's like trying to put a computer on your face, similar to like the Vision Pro of Apple.
Yeah.
That, again, completely failed. They're trying to put them into Ray-Bans and other things. It seems like a good idea, but they're spending billions on Quest and Orion glasses because they need distribution. Right now, Facebook is kind of a component that you access through Chrome or you know, Google Chrome or Apple, Safari and Apple phones.
Yeah.
So all these things mean that it's hard for Meta to make money if Apple and Google decide to like tax Meta for things.
Right.
So they're trying to find their new outlets. So if this new ploy doesn't work, then what you have is, you know, essentially hundreds of billions down the drain.
Yeah, absolutely. And they really have taken passes at hardware in the past and they've not necessarily materialized. I don't necessarily see the story, so I do feel this is a major Achilles heel for them, and they are betting the farm on it. And meanwhile, you know, Zuck's a little distracted as he's sitting out in a courtroom right now getting berated about whether or not he intentionally is creating apps that are addictive for children.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not sure. He actually just testified this week, so it'll be interesting to see if reports come out of his testimony whether social media is addictive.
Spoiler.
Yes, spoiler. We knew that 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, spoiler. Yes, it is.
All right. OpenAI is actually having a show me the money moment, which, you know, that's a, you know, I kind of love that movie.
Oh my gosh, Jerry Maguire. It's the best. It's
essentially, we're talking about the fact that they're investing so much in so many different business models, from like ads to commerce to subscriptions to consumer. Which one of these is going to pay off? And if you have three or four business models, ultimately, do you really have one at all?
Yeah.
Anthropic has been on a tear. There are a lot of people raving about the new Claude 4.6 model and like Claude Cowork, which is like blowing people's minds.
Yeah.
Codex is better, but Gemini has kind of, you know, my opinion, caught up to ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
And if OpenAI can't beat Anthropic on the coding side, then it needs to be best in class at probably a number of things for this to be completely successful, especially since commerce, I think it's going to be important for them. I think it's be important for research and consideration. But as far as a transactional revenue source, Amazon is pretty well defended.
Yeah.
And so they, in their next 12 months, like what will their core business be is really, to me, my existential question.
Right. Well, and it's similar to the Meta example you gave. They are a feature or an app on another phone or a device.
Right.
While Apple and Google figure out what their ecosystem is, we've already talked about Gemini having so much distribution already just by nature of Android phones. So OpenAI doesn't necessarily have distribution innately built in it, right? They have to rely on someone else to help them with distribution and scale. And when you have all of these disparate business models, it is kind of hard to see where's the real traction going to be. And they have brought in more people to like think revenue, right? Mm. So we know that they've been bolstering their executive team to think about monetization and to find those outlets. But it doesn't feel like that innovation itself is happening enough. And the ads component is sort of blown up in their face a little bit as Claude has thrown some shade that we talked about earlier in the Super Bowl ads. So, you know, is that a little chink in the armor? Is it a blip? We'll have to see.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, between Amazon, Shopify, Meta, and OpenAI, all of these companies have risks. It doesn't mean they're all materialized, but these are the things that we're kind of watching on the show. Yeah. What are you seeing? If you have news for the show, let us know. Like, we have an email address, tips@watsonweekly.com. If there are things that you would like us to talk about, we're all ears. And so we're happy to, you know, we're here for you.
That's right. We are here for you, friends, and to give that take that only this crew is equipped to do. Rick, I think we've wrapped the show. We've hit a lot and covered a lot. Anything you want to leave the viewers with as we close out the episode?
Yeah, this week, I think we're going to be watching, you know, continuing to break down Walmart earnings. We're heading into sort of the dads and grads, you know, Mother's Day coming up. And, you know, we just threw Valentine's Day. So there are a number of I call it mini holidays in the retail season before we get to the summer doldrums.
Don't forget Easter. That bunny's got to come.
Yeah, the bunny's got to come. We're excited about the retail season. So if you're following us, stay bold, stay classy, and listen for us next week.
That's right. Have a good weekend.